muddle on. Okay, second half of the lecture for the recording. Yes, so there's actually quite a fine point that Jonas is making in this essay, and I hope to get it across in the second half of the lecture. So, I mean, the thing he wants to say now is that in this second part of the essay is that we started off with a dualism. With Descartes, everything begins with D, that although problematic, was in a certain sense coherent. It gave an explanation for, if you like, both dimensions, the material physical and the conscious psychic. Both dimensions were given a place in this Descartes dualism. What was problematic was how these two entirely independent realms were going to interact, because Descartes still had a role for the res cogitans, our soul or intellect or consciousness. Still was able to act through the brain and have effects on the res extensor, on the material world. So we still had a dualism where our beings could actually make decisions and affect things. And if you like, on our side in the res cogitans was the realm of ideas that could still operate. And we had reason and the light of reason. These are all things on the side of consciousness. And the material nature that was a mechanism lacked all of that. But there was a breadth there that accounted for everything that we immediately experience. It was problematic when people started to say, oh, well, exactly how does this immaterial soul substance interact with this material extended stuff? And there was an idea that it must be through the brain, and there was the pineal gland, and somehow or other the immaterial stuff could actually cause things to happen in the brain that would control the body. There was some idea like that in Descartes, not very well thought out. But if you were to start to try and look for something like that anatomically in the brain, there is no such centre of influence. The brain is just an enormous interacting web or network of processes that are all coming alive and dying away. And there's absolutely no evidence of there being any kind of place where some disembodied immaterial spirit influences the brain. That doesn't mean it doesn't, but there's certainly no evidence to think that. So the problem of the interaction, I think Descartes, if he was questioned on that, he probably was, but I don't know his works that well, he'd probably advert to God in the end. And various different philosophers thought that. The only way you could say dualism was to say, well, God arranges it so that there's a parallelism between what's happening in the physical and what's happening in the mental, as it came to be called the mental, as it was sort of desacralized. We think of it as the mental. There was a parallelism so that when certain things happen in the brain, then you have certain experiences, and when you decide to do something, then certain things happen in the brain, and if you like, God sorts it out. God causes it all to work. And this was, you could see, because Jonas mentions Descartes' dualism was problematic. It was problematic, this interactionism. It starts to look like a fudge, like something that a French philosopher has made up. which, in fact, is what it was in a way. But then you get, but and that's in a way that would be a Darwinian understanding of all philosophy. It's just something that some brain has made up, except for Darwinism itself. So dualism was a kind of already an unhappy kind of compromise with problems where you couldn't really fit it together, and a lot of people working in philosophy were aware of that from the get-go. And Berkeley and Leibniz both came down on the side of saying, well, you can't really, and Hume as well, you can't really support the idea of there being any physical at all. So you get a certain kind of idealism developed that says, well, it must all, in a way, be happening in this domain of mind. And in the domain of mind, we have a kind of an experience of there being a physical world, but it's not really there independent of the mind. The mind just presents this movie or this projection or this film of there being a material world, but that doesn't mean that there is a material world. There's nothing to say that there is. There's no proof that you could offer that there is. And the great argument of idealism is, and the one thing that you are certain of, is that there is a world of consciousness, because you're experiencing it now. It's the only thing you do have certainty about. So you can't deny it, but you can deny the physical. So idealism has a consistency about it that can't be destroyed by any kind of argument, but it was never going to be embraced by the great mass of people who, because of our, Husserl would say, because of the natural attitude. The natural attitude it remains completely unconscious of the fact that this is all occurring in consciousness. Yes, that the natural attitude just sees the world of objects and accepts that the being of that world as it presents itself to be. And that's such a deeply felt sense of the order and the way things are, that when Berkeley was first, when they first read Berkeley, it was Samuel Pepys, was it, who said, "I refute it thus," and kicked a stone. Samuel Johnson. Yeah, I knew it began with S. And in a way, that's it. That's everyone's natural response. What you say, it's not really there. Boom! What do you say to that? But which, of course, is a misunderstanding of idealism. But that's how arguments, philosophical positions are decided often at that level of simplicity, for the culture as a whole. Something like an idealism held sway in the East, though. So it's not that we don't have cultures that do embrace a certain idealism, but not certainly not in the practical West. And it, at the same time, the success of material science, in terms of its ability to predict and understand and develop technologies as a basis of that understanding, was treated as a proof that the material world is really real. Of course, it isn't. Nothing that you can do will prove that idealism is false. But there's a certain level of understanding where, and John Searle, who's quite a talented American philosopher, says, you can't reject materialism after you've put a man on the moon, can you? It's just not that he was a diehard materialist, but he's saying you can't reject the reality of the material world after all of that science that was based on it being a real world has achieved what it has achieved. But all it really implies is that there is some kind of structure that is the universe. Now, whether that structure is in a mind or is in a physical space, you can't say, but the structure is certainly has a reality for us. But the fact that our culture became predominantly materialistic it's like, why did the First World War start? There are many historical reasons for it, and we're just tracing one of them here. One of them was that Descartes' dualism was somewhat incoherent, and at the same time, the materialistic science that was based on one half of it was becoming rampantly successful, and if you like, those aspects of the world that were based on the res cogitans, the side of idealism, weren't achieving anything. They were just arguing and discussing and producing philosophical papers and theories of this and theories of that, but going nowhere. And materialistic science, I think you could say, is unparalleled in its coherence and ability to have obviously progressed, such that one generation builds on the work of another. It doesn't just say, oh, it's all rubbish, start again. Our science doesn't say Newton was all rubbish, let's start again. Our science says, no, Newton had a brilliant insight, and we've stood on Newton's shoulders. That's the phrase, isn't it? I stood on the shoulders of giants. You generally don't find that in almost every other area of human endeavour. You just find somebody, some idea or some position gains precedence for a little while, and then it's shot down, and then another one comes up that's kind of equally as bad, like the world of politics. And to an extent, you could say psychological theory, although there may be some argument to say that we've incrementally and in a tiny way got a slightly better understanding of psychology over the years, but certainly not in the way that materialistic science has progressed. So it, by default, materialism got a hold because of the failure of religion, psychology, human sciences to make any kind of progress. You know, the one side prospered, the other didn't. So the side that prospered, it's like seemed to be more coherent. Its underpinnings, which is taking the reality of the material world to be as it appears to be in our sensory experience, seems the obvious thing to do. Thinking that way produces results, and doesn't just produce results, it produces Western European civilization that then develops technology that dominates the rest of the earth. So it proves itself by its actions. And Darwinism also comes along and says the particular brand of dualism that Descartes proposed is obviously false in another way, because Descartes' view was, again, this is comes from Christianity, was that only the human beings have this soul substance. The animals don't. And he genuinely thought or proposed that a dog doesn't feel pain, that they're all automata. Only human beings have an eternal soul, which is the Christian view that we were created in the image of God, and that the world was created by God for our for us to be lord over all that we survey. And not just that, there's views that the world is somehow fallen under the sway of devilish influences as well. So there was already in Christianity this kind of separation between the soul of man, capital N, including woman, who was part of this other world connected to God, with the angels in between and a few devils floating about as well, and then this material world that was created by God as a kind of a stage or a theatre for this drama of human existence to be enacted on. So you see why Descartes chose res cogitans just to be a human thing. But the thing about evolution that was a great shock to that view was that it became obvious that the species evolved incrementally, bit by bit. Well, there's just tiny changes, and the mammals evolve, and then the apes evolve, and then the great apes evolve, and then humanity evolves out of the great apes incrementally, and there are little changes in between, and there's no great moment of creation that says, and then there was Adam and Eve. It's clear that there was no clear line where you could divide the human mind from the minds of the other species. Evolution just shows a continual gradation. Slightly smaller brain, tiny brain, reptilian brain. You know, going back, the plants don't have a brain, but they are alive. You know, there's the whole of life forms these continuous chains of development, where there's absolutely no evidence for there being some kind of lord of all creation that suddenly appeared, which was also part of this Descartes view that only human beings had this consciousness. So evolution and the evidence of evolution, not just the theory of evolution, but the evidence of evolution, once you started looking into the fossil records, just said, well, the Descartian dualism doesn't work. Now, that actually doesn't mean that another kind of dualism doesn't work. There's a dualism that says, all right, there's a dualism between mind and matter, and the animals have mind as well. You could, and there is such more modern dualism thinks that way. But at the time, you basically had a view that collapsed, and the only remaining part of it that seemed coherent was the material part. So you ended up with a materialistic monism, meaning one, rather dualism is two. It was one half of the Descartes dualism proved or demonstrated itself to be incoherent. But it's like you're dealing in a way. When I was thinking about this for the course, you're sort of dealing somewhere with like maybe an 8-year-old child, although that would be to be rude to an 8-year-old child. The kind of collective falling into this kind of materialistic view of things seems to have been done without really being thought about. Because in effect, the great body of people working in science became materialists by default because they are trained to look at the world in a certain way. Not as philosophers, but just trained to look at the world in a certain way. And slowly they become the authorities that we listen to and still do, right? When we want an expert on about how the brain works, we phone up David Eagleman, right? And even David Attenborough is essentially materialistic in his understanding of how nature works. So the specialists, the scientific specialists, are materialistic by training, not by having done a philosophy course. And philosophy itself becomes marginalised. Partly it's its own fault, because philosophy didn't come up with a coherent counterposition to materialism. It basically came up with a whole bunch of people who, especially in Western civilization, who attempted to try and make a materialistic monism coherent. So they devoted their entire intellects into saying, well, this isn't. Almost like, I sense this from Dennett, this is a challenge. I mean, on the surface, it seems impossible to make materialism work, because, of course, we've got consciousness and subjectivity. How on earth could we explain consciousness and subjectivity within a materialistic monism? There must be a way, and away we go, right? It becomes an amazing philosophical challenge to try and do that. And, of course, the people who are working away at doing that then give the people who work in science a kind of a sense that there's a philosophical foundation for what they're doing. You see, it's almost a social phenomenon, and the people who are working against that, I mean, by and large, they became known as continental philosophers, and they you know, that's not my area, but you could say they became somewhat undisciplined. That would be one way of putting it, Disagree amongst themselves, and made outrageous claims about science that scientists themselves were able to easily refute. You know, there was a famous book, whose name I forget and whose authors I forget, that were completely debunked postmodernism by, there was this journal of postmodernist philosophy, and these couple of scientists got together and just wrote a spoof postmodernist philosophy paper all about quantum physics and mathematics and etc., etc. And it was just a total joke. And they submitted it to the journal and it was published. And then they wrote a book about postmodernism and said, do you see what a fraud it is? They're talking about all of this science and they haven't the first idea what it all means. And it actually sowed the seeds of the decline of postmodernism, that paper. It's kind of, it was, and again, it wasn't a reasoned argument. Do you see how these things move in strange ways? Events like wars, the fact that people accepted Cartesianism and then it was shown to be incoherent. It's not as if anyone ever sat down and said, well, let's look at this. What would be a truly coherent philosophical position that we could come to an agreement about as our responsibility? You know, the great society of philosophy. It's never happened. It's just it's been shattered into these multiple views, multiple philosophies of individual philosophers. So in a way, what goes on behind that in the culture? Is as I was saying, it was like the whole decision about the philosophy that we work on a day-to-day basis is like it was chosen by an 8-year-old boy. But to answer, and I think the slide's coming, well, it's coming soon. One of the great things about the theory of evolution, and this is what you were saying, Maria, is that it gave consciousness back to the animals as well. It didn't, because in the Victorian era it was horrifying. You know, they thought it was just horrifying to say that we were related to the apes. You know, because Victorian people they'd gone a bit strange about their animal natures. But that's another Freudian and Jungian question, isn't it? What the Victorians were about, but they definitely repressed their bestiality, and that might be an explanation for the wars that were fought, really, because you repress it comes out. But I don't want to go into that. I'd like you to. This is an interesting look at evolution. Yeah, Jonas is quite. This is a little section in the middle of the paper where he's very clear, and I'd like you to see that this is. Because a lot of people, when they start to discuss evolution, say, well, it's just a scientific fact. evolution. Jonas is a philosopher enough to say, well, it's a mixture of fact, hypothesis, and deduction, and this is how it lies. And it's a fact that the species do change. A fact as in something that you can observe from the fossil records. Not just that, you can observe it from breeding colonies of bacteria in real time. You don't just have to look back. And you can learn a lot from breeding peas and plants and creating hybrids. And, you know, Mendel, who was involved in studying heredity, studied peas. But it's a fact that the species change, and that if you go back in time, they branch from common descent. Although the very talk that you were showing was saying things are a bit more complex than that. There is lateral drift in genes that he wasn't aware of. But it's certainly the view, if you like, that at some time, maybe 3.5 billion years ago, there were situations, probably in the oceans, where there were molecules that were able to self-replicate, which means they had a certain structure, a bit like DNA, where other simpler molecules would become conjoined to those more complex molecules, and then split off again. And so you'd have molecules in a way that were able, like happens in a cell, to construct copies of themselves and out of the material that was floating in the ocean. So you start theorising, yeah, it's quite possible by chance that self-replicating molecules could start to occur, and self-replicating chains of molecules that are involved in certain kinds of chemical transformations could occur in the ocean, because this is what happens in cells in metabolism. You get a metabolism is a kind of a machine for assembling molecules that then engage in you can call them chemical reactions, but in process of transformation that produce the materials that are required to make that very process of metabolism continue. So that there's a certain circular chain of transformation of molecules where the products to produce this particular molecule are produced there in this chain. And the results of that particular interaction produce some other complex molecule. We're looking at proteins here, there. And then that transforms into that, transforms into that, transforms into that, that then joins back to that. If you see, you get cyclic transformations of highly complex hydrocarbon molecules that could conceivably be occurring just by, when you say chance, there's a lot more to it than that, which we might go into later. There's something inherent in the structure of the elements that is going to cause that to happen. But it's all explicable in terms of the laws of physics. And then you need to see that membranes could form. Membranes do form quite naturally. The next thing you require is a membrane forming around one of these self-sustaining chemical processes that are self-sustaining. And as soon as you've got a membrane forming around it, you've got the beginnings of a prototype of a cell. But it still can't copy itself. But it's like one day there's a cell that actually is capable of copying itself, and its membrane splits and produces an identical cell. And it's sucking in, I nearly called it information. It's sucking material in from the ocean. The point about this being, as soon as it's capable of doing it once, this is how life works, right? The two that have gone off there are just going to suck more material in from the ocean, and they're going to split. And the two there, the four there, are all going to suck more material in from the ocean, and they're going to split. And pretty soon, they're going to use up all the available material and just reproduce like crazy. This is the beginning of life on Earth, explained mechanistically. Now, the details are still shady, but it's starting to become more and more plausible, to the extent that people are looking at making it happen again in the lab. They haven't done it yet, but they're creating similar chains of chemical processes that are occurring, and they're looking at constructing things with membranes with chemical reactions going on inside of them, but nothing that self-replicates yet. But the whole study is going on into it. How are we going to make it happen? When I say we, scientists love to say that as if we're involved as well. It's all of us together. Yeah. So the idea of common descent goes back to that, right? Once that's going, the theory of evolution says it's all right, we can do all the rest. Yes, Ali. Yes. Yes. It's Nicolette's the key. Key lady, yes.
You know that goes in there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So, for those of you, I'm assuming you do know this, but the two mechanisms of evolution are mutation and natural selection. Those are the two basic principles. The idea being, chance takes care of the initial coming together of the first cell. Now, yeah, and now it's still that's not to say that's how it did happen, but this is we basically say we once upon a time thought that was a miracle. Maybe God had to come in and create another miracle, but now it's generally considered, especially with development of complexity theory, that it's remarkable how organized matter can be. In the way that it structures itself, and in the sorts of processes that it develops. And it's becoming, the more people look into it, it's becoming more and more conceivable that something like that could have happened and would happen on other planets and other parts of the universe.
A lot of readers of Darwin sometimes uses words like, expressions like, nature favours this species or that species. And the readers of Darwin, they didn't reach to a conclusion that everything is mechanistic. They reached a conclusion that nature is a force and it favors this and favors that. And therefore, we should kind of, like, the eugenics came out of,
yes, but favor means favor is natural selection.
Like nature as it is a god and it selects.
But Darwin's, I think, is also recognised as having said that I used the language metaphorically. So the deeper down in Origin of Species, it's when we say nature favours something, we mean that natural selection favours something, and natural selection is entirely mechanistic.
A lot of his readers didn't really kind of got that mechanism.
No.
Like his nephew created the whole eugenics movement.
Yes.
And the Nazis were all used the eugenics. So
yes.
Eugenics came out of Darwin's nephew. If his nephew is not understanding him, then who's all going to understand?
But no, but eugenics, you know, has a kind of an idea.
Sorry, can I just, what is eugenics?
It's the idea of, like Hitler, breeding a sort of a... controlling the breeding of the human race in order to promote certain desirable features like strength and intelligence.
Like the Nazi.
Yeah, trying to manage evolution and bring it under human control. But that hasn't gone away. We're just going to do it with cells rather than by choosing who mates with whom, aren't we? In a way, we are already doing it, aren't we?
There's that whole argument about whether, now that they've got the ability to scan fetuses, there's that whole argument about should people be allowed to afford fetuses in Paraguay?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Nature favours, to me, it means that nature has some sort of a taste.
No, there's no teleology whatsoever. Teleology meaning end in mind. In the theory of evolution, and if you say that that there is, you're just using language in a metaphorical or flowery way. It's quite clear, and I guess we should say when we're talking about Darwinism now, we call it neo-Darwinism, because Darwin didn't know about DNA, and there were great gaps in his knowledge of how the species evolved. He was punting, guessing that it would be that way on the basis of evidence, particularly from the Galapagos Islands. But the idea that there was no teleology in what Darwin was proposing. And a word like favours implies that there was something that was doing the favouring, but in theory, the theory of evolution says no, there's nothing like that. If a species is favoured, that just means that it's more able to reproduce, more successfully being able to reproduce. That's the criteria of success. That's one criteria of success. I should pause there. Not necessarily simple as that, you know, because sometimes being able to just sustain yourself and survive for a little while rather than reproduce until you use up all the resources and die is a better strategy. So sometimes population control could be a useful long-term survival strategy. But if it is, evolution will discover that entirely accidentally. That's the theory, right? How does evolution discover the kinds of entities that are going to survive?
Yeah.
It doesn't do any discovering as a metaphor. When cells reproduce, the copying mechanism isn't perfect. So, and not just that, if you've got male and female, then the resulting DNA that comes out of it is an unpredictable combination of the DNA of the parent. So you get a certain amount of variation from male and female mating, and a certain amount of variation from imperfect copying, and that variation is enough to cause different features in the offspring. And then natural selection takes care then of the rest of evolution it doesn't say anything. It says only those who survive. You know, it's not a deep principle. If some combination of DNA produces a weak body that isn't able to run very fast, and you're out on the veldt, and you're prey to the lions, then the lions are going to eat you, basically. Put it in a nutshell, and that would be a way of saying, nature favours the gazelle with the slightly longer legs. So the gazelle, over eons of time, the gazelle's legs get longer, so do the muscles. And there's no plan in it. It's entirely sculpted and shaped by what's going on in the rest of the environment. So there's nothing. There's no teleology in it. But back to this. Mutation is a fact, but not its nature or cause. All right, so there's an assumption that if there is a mutation in the reproduction of a cell, that it's purely by chance, or there's some environmental factor like radiation. So in laboratory tests have shown that you can enforce mutation on DNA. You put the cell under stress in some way or other, and that can cause imperfect copying. But it's not in any way or mean been demonstrated that the way that what we call mutation occurs is entirely by chance. Of course, the alternative, which is sort of horrifying to the kind of science that we have, is that there's some agency that produces a certain change in the DNA. But in fact, this isn't my area, but there's a certain materialistic science is coming up with better and better explanations about what's going on in the cell, and certainly it's the case that the DNA has an enormous amount of potential proteins that you can synthesize from it. So it's not as if you just get passed on a piece of DNA and that determines your body and how you're going to grow and how you're going to act. It all depends on what parts of the DNA are actually being used, and what parts of the DNA are actually being used is determined by the what's in the rest of the cell. So there's an enormous amount of variability within how the DNA is expressed in the cell. So there's a certain amount of thinking now in biology that says, it could be that the environment does have an effect on how the DNA is expressed.
Epigenetics.
Yes, yes. Because it was in Jonas's time, it was a big pill to swallow to think that all of the variability that we see in the species could be explained by chance alone. But it's like evolutionary theory is coming up with its own eyes. Actually, there's a lot more going on in the cell than we thought that can explain, right down to the fact that effects of what people have been through in concentration camps, the sort of stress that's put the body's cells under, that state of stress actually gets passed on to the children and determines how their DNA is expressed. So there's a lot more going on than Jonas knew about in those days. So that the idea of mutation is being broadened now, but broadened still within this mathematical, mechanistic view of things. And it's still open whether there isn't some psychic dimension. or psychic influence that could operate at the cellular level. It's just to propose something like that is so antithetical to our scientific worldview that if you were to attempt to suggest such a thing in the annals of academia, again, it's one of those things, don't expect any more grants, will you? You're free to publish that. Just go right ahead, because you won't be up for promotion next time, and I will be. You know, no more grants for you, no more promotion. You could suggest something like that, but nobody's going to until they've got some hard evidence, and hard evidence for something like that is very hard to come by. It's difficult to explain that when there's a certain mindset in a community, especially, and science is the same, that to suggest something that proposes another kind of dimension or another kind of cause is almost impossible until the current view has collapsed. Yeah, the current view has to collapse. There has to be a crisis before some other more extreme view is going to be countenanced, for good reason, because otherwise science would become chaotic. Yeah, you just have 50 different crazy ideas and everybody's publishing them and you wouldn't know where you stood. So I don't want to say something like, yeah, that's terrible that science is so closed-minded. It gets its stability and its ability to progress from that, from closing off crazy ideas. But it could be that one of those crazy ideas is true. You know, that's the price you pay there. So Jonas is saying, yeah, we don't know what the cause of mutation is. That's not a fact. The chance character of mutations is a hypothesis, but it is a fact. That they can be induced by external forces. And then here's his most controversial statement. The claim that these are representative for all mutations, that all mutation is caused by chance, is a mere trial with Occam's razor. Which is, what that means is Occam's razor says you don't introduce elements into your explanation more than is necessary. So materialistic science says, well, the absolute minimum that we have is matter and the laws of physics. Yeah, and we don't want to introduce any other principles into our explanation, like that that there's a cosmic mind that influences evolution, for instance. We don't want to introduce anything like that, any supernatural forces, anything at all, unless we absolutely have to, right? Unless we're faced with something that we can't explain without introducing some other principle. And it turns out we can explain evolution entirely materialistically. The evolution of material bodies can be explained entirely materialistically. Occam's razor says, well, we don't introduce anything else unless we have to. There are gaps along the way. There are, subsequent to Jonas writing this, Stephen Jay Gould criticized this gradualistic view of evolution and said that actually the fossil records show that what really happens in evolution is punctuated equilibrium. In fact, what happens is that species remain remarkably stable for long, long periods of time, and then there's some kind of event happens or some change happens in the environment that puts the species under stress, and it's usually in those situations that evolution, if you like, happens, that there are dramatic changes. Dramatic changes generally correspond to changes in the environment. And it's not as if the species go on this steady ascendant climb. It's more like they stay very... They may diversify. I mean, you get the idea. They diversify because living's quite easy. So many, many different possibilities survive at the same time. It's only when it comes under stress that a lot of culled, there's a few survivors, and we get a definite and distinct change. And it's still quite mysterious how new species occur. Species being, it's all to do with who can reproduce with whom. So you get a new species when this individual's only... it reproduces with other individuals that are like they are, and not with the previous population out of which they evolved. But even then, there must be a period of transition, where the new kind of mutation is still mating with the old. But then often it's the case that the intervening in between transition from one species to another disappear and die out, and we have to hunt the fossil records. But when you do hunt the fossil records, it does seem that there is this evidence that there are periods of intense change, periods of stability, intense change, periods of stability. And Jonas wouldn't have known about that at this point. But his point here is the whole theory of evolution, that there's no teleology, that there's nothing behind mutation. That's not proven. And he's quietly suggesting, but not, that the door is open for all kinds of other kinds of influences to affect the way that the species evolve. That there could be some kind of, he's not saying this, but some kind of Gaia, you know, whole earth consciousness, that in these periods of punctuated equilibrium, when there's dramatic changes and new species evolve, that there could be some other influence that's affecting things. Again, if you were a Christian, and you wanted to keep God alive or keep intelligence alive, there's still plenty of room. In there are gaps in the whole theory of evolution. How the first cell formed. There's a lot of ifs and buts in that. The evolution of entirely new species in these periods of intense change. It's not entirely clear that can be explained entirely by chance alone. And the morphogenesis of an individual, how each individual, the sort of pattern of the form of how the bodies grow, it's not entirely clear that can be explained mechanistically. there are holes in the theory. I guess the thing is that 100 years ago, the holes were that big. Now, they're that big. So it's like materialistic science has had a lot of success in narrowing the size of the holes, you know, in providing better and better explanations about how these things could be explained mechanistically. Whether they'll finally be closed or not, again, is I don't think you can ever finally conclude anything when you're reasoning about the past and you're reasoning about events like reproduction that are unique. You see, you can't have the same sperm and the same egg reproduce over and over and over and over. Each event is unique, so that it's not the kind of science that you can do like physics, where you just produce the same interaction between the same particles over and over and over because all the particles are identical. Now, when you're dealing with cells and reproduction of cells, every cell is unique, so you can't get the same kind of experimental certainty. But you can certainly provide better and better explanations, and the evolutionary theory has provided better and better explanations about how what seemed inconceivable, that you could explain us being here mechanistically, is looking more and more conceivable. They didn't run into some inescapable obstacle to this mode of explanation. So this is a good slide. We're not finishing yet, but this is a good slide to kind of recognize the positivity of this, because the thing is to grasp what an extraordinary idea it is, this idea of evolution, that life produced itself out of itself. Do you see, it's like a principle that just made itself out of itself. There was no external agency saying it shall be like this. There's no plan behind it. There's no blueprint. There's no nothing. What you've just got, this extraordinary physical process that just keeps up throwing up more and more and more life forms that then the environment basically culls and shapes and forms, and then this process, this extraordinary life process, which I like to regard it as one single process that stretches back to those first cells that formed in the primordial or primeval ocean. Because if you think about it in a way, there would have been a bit of DNA there in that primordial ocean that, in a way, it's still with us. You know, it copied and copied and copied and copied itself. But if you think of it as a process, the entire process of life on Earth is just one process. We're all little branches on it. And this is, do you see what an extraordinary... Nobody had thought there could ever be such a thing. Yeah, everybody thought, oh, there must have been a God who said, oh, let there be ants, let there be birds, let there be trees. The idea of evolution just banged by it was by doing science and looking at the fossil records and by theorizing, suddenly this idea emerged of this extraordinary what we would call creative process that's just produced everything here. Now, what Hans Jonas was saying, I think, is that the thing about mechanistic science is it considers that extraordinary process to be entirely without intelligence, for there to be no intelligence in it whatsoever. Whereas if you're a spiritually oriented person, you'd say it's absolutely full of intelligence. Why? And I've got a good answer to that. Because I'm intelligent. It's absolutely full of intelligence because I have the evidence of my own being, right? And I'm part of this. I'm jumping ahead there, but I thought I'd better jump ahead as to why would you think that there's a problem with this entirely mechanistic understanding of life? Well, because it's up until everything that we've been saying about it up until now, it was entirely based on only looking at it at the exterior, the res extensa. It's entirely missed the fact that there's an interiority, that being alive involves having experience. That remains completely outside the sphere of this approach. This approach, it just doesn't show up in this approach, because this approach is just looking at bodies, molecules, atoms, fossil records.
It's crazy how the white cells study the virus and go back and come up with some kind of an antibiotic.
But when you say that, I'm split. You know, I'm split on this. I do think that an inordinate amount of what goes on in our bodies is entirely mechanistic. Otherwise, mechanistic science just could not have achieved what it achieves. That things really do obey laws. They really don't deviate. If there's any kind of intelligence nudging things in any way, it's doing it in the most extraordinarily obscure and difficult to recognise way. It's almost like there is some kind of, you know, Descartes was talking about there being a deceiving demon. It's almost like there's a deceiving demon that says, okay, humans, you just want to look at the material universe and think that everything can be explained like that. All right, I'll dish you up the very thing that you're expecting to find. Yes, so you get what you're looking for, right? You want an entirely materialistic explanation of everything? I'll give it to you. Of course, you can never explain the consciousness, right, that's observing it. But that's my joke. That's my joke on you.
So you're saying that we need to think about how come we have developed into conscious beings from a universe where no consciousness apparently existed.
No, I'm not saying that.
Right.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I haven't said anything of that nature. I'm just saying that there's a view here that says we can explain all of evolution of life on Earth as best, according to the evidence, as being an entirely mechanistic affair. And I'm saying, and Hans Jonas is going to say again, yes, except for the fact that there is being alive involves us having inhabiting this psychic dimension. So there's something missing from that mechanistic explanation. Of course there is, and we're looking at the history. Of course there is. It's the other half that Descartes carved off. Of course there is. We're not to ask mechanistic science to provide an account for our subjectivity is absurd, because it can't, because it was set up in the very first instance to only look at the material. But then it got amnesia. You know, around about the theory of evolution, it got amnesia and it thought, well, everything is made of matter, that's all there is. It's a very simple story of a certain kind of almost stupidity. Yes, that just says it must all be material because we don't find anything else. You know, everything can be explained this way. Now, the fact it can be explained so successfully in this way itself is very interesting, though. I find that very interesting. I did when I first was studying this. I thought, yes, if there were a God, that God has definitely, absolutely hidden itself from this approach, this materialistic approach, almost deliberately said, no, you ain't going to find me here. Obviously you're going to find me in the other half that you've cast off. if there is such a thing, if there is anything behind this universe, if there's anything behind the mutating of these cells, you're not going to find it by looking in the material.
There's another thing. Sometimes the cell commits suicide.
Yes.
In order to just kill itself and the virus in it.
Yes.
But
that's whenever the thing is, I'm a diehard materialist at a certain level. I say, well, of course it does, right? Because one of them, at a certain point, accidentally did that. The creature who had cells that committed suicide when they had viruses in them survived better. Do you see? It's.
But if you're attributing consciousness to the cell, isn't that a kind of anthropomorphization cell? I mean, you're attributing human conscious qualities. You're suggesting that the cell has got motivation or feeling or making judgments.
Yes.
And
yes.
It doesn't necessarily. It may have, but it's also possible that it just happens automatically.
Yes. That's the.
I'm not saying it does, but it somehow suggests that there is somehow a purpose. Has a sense. This cell has an idea of a purpose.
Now this is Hans Jonas's position, right? When you get to the end of this particular essay, he's saying, "Well, there is inwardness, there is consciousness, because I'm conscious, yes. And if you look into nature, to think that just human beings are conscious." It seems absurd. It's everything's very, very gradual. So clearly, one's intuitive sense of the animals is that they're conscious. Maybe not self-conscious, but there's consciousness there. When they look out of their eyes, they see something. When they get hurt, they feel something. So does it stop with the mammals? And then you look at the snakes, and you think, no, I don't think so. And we get down to the insect, and we're saying, I'm not sure. Especially when it bites me, right? but why would we? If you look into the physical structure of the insect, there seems to be no reason why we should say draw a line there, right? Hans Jonas is of the opinion that the only obvious place to draw the line is with the living cell, because that's where we define life as starting. So he would be saying something like, well, it seems, and he's just purely on the most reasonable explanation. Everything seems to be a gradual. The more sophisticated we get, the more refined our brains get, the more refined our experience. You can read our experience off our brains, right? But there doesn't seem to be a point where there's no sensitivity until you get out of the living cell into the. Just the molecular, or what's called inorganic world. The only obvious dividing line, and we'll look into this in the next class, is between the inorganic and the organic. There's a big gap there. I mean, again, modern science is looking at that and saying, is there such a big gap? But there's certainly the self-creating, self-reproducing cell is something utterly distinct from molecules floating about in the sea, assembling themselves and disassembling themselves. Logically, there's a big logical gap between those two, because the cell, the being of the cell, is defined by the process that it's engaged in, not by the material out of which it's made. Now, that's a key idea that's at the heart of this course. Even the chasm, a molecule is just if you like matter, as in it's made up of stuff that just is continuous in time and unchanging, although it might join and form bonds and fall apart, but the being of a molecule is just the being of what we would call matter. Even if you look into the molecule, you'll find there's an awful lot going on behind that. But it's got an unchangingness about it that as soon as you get to a living cell, you find that it doesn't have the being of a molecule. what you find in a living cell is that molecules are coming in and going out in a continuous cycle all the time. And if that cycle ever stops, so that the cell just is fixed matter, that means it's dead. So being alive is a process. So ontologically, it's entirely different to the being of a molecule. And Hans Jonas's main point in these two essays is, okay, if there's a line anywhere, it's there.
Being and becoming.
Well, that would be one saying, the molecule is being and the cell is becoming. But the cell has a certain... Its being is its becoming.
Okay.
Yes? Its being is the very... So long, because it's got a higher level... it's not the being of molecules. It's the being of a certain form of organisation. A certain organisation of a certain process. So it has a sort of an abstract, immaterial being. Yes, the process that's going on in the cell isn't material. It's defined by the fact that the process has the correct form. So long as the process has the correct form, then the cell is alive. And so long as all the cells in your body have the correct form, and then the form of their interactions together is of the correct form, then you're alive. So being alive is not a material, not an attribute of matter. It's an attribute of it's defined by a certain kind of process that matter is engaged in. And Jonas's reasoning, and I accept this, is that the most reasonable thing to assume then is that interiority, exteriority, experience. Is associated with living and dying, the living and dying of these processes.
That's quite a nice idea.
It's like an operating factory.
It sort of connects us not just to animals, but to everything that's alive.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
So his view is that is basically the more sophisticated the living system is, and the more sensitive it is to the environment in which it lives, the richer is its experience. So that if you like a living cell, you could kind of picture just has a vague sense of maybe well-being from having being in the right chemical environment, and a faint feeling of not having well-being or dislike or discomfort from being denied nutrients. Yes. Yeah, it probably has no window outside of itself. It may have a vague sense of the being a me and a not me, and a liking and not liking.
The whole galaxy could be like that as well. It's like a process.
Yeah. You mentioned Rupert Sheldrake. He thinks that the solar system is something like that, that it has a certain experience. I'm not sure I'm following Rupert in that direction. As phenomenologists, we can't really conclude anything beyond our own immediate experience, but there's a certain reasonableness to this sense that experience spreads through the species. It's not something that you can prove, but you would say that that's something that you would accept until you had compelling evidence to the contrary. Yes.
We all started off as single cells, didn't we?
Yep. that's it. That's another proof, right?
I mean, I know somebody, and I'm going to take this with a pinch of salt because they were quite weird, but she, through primal therapy, said that she'd gone not just back into the womb, but back into her experiencing her conception, becoming a single cell,
yes,
and implanting herself into the lining of the womb.
Yes.
And apparently that's not uncommon in people who go through primal therapy. I mean, I've experienced it myself. But you can go back into very, very early experiences. And you don't experience them as you experience all, like, what did I do yesterday? Or I went to the shops. It's not like that. Your body reenacts things through through something called body memory.
Yes.
It's quite interesting, because she was convinced that she'd experienced this, and she wasn't, I mean, she's a bit unusual, but she's certainly not mad and highly intelligent person.
Yeah, yeah, no, I was reading all about primal scream therapy when I was at Warwick, but I never went into it, actually, myself. But it was John Lennon was into that originally, wasn't he?
Yeah.
It was influential for him. Yeah, I was quite influenced by those ideas myself. But in a way that's you kind of have to treat that as if it has therapeutic value, then that's all it requires. Whether it's objectively true, how can you assess that?
Well, you can't. But I'm just saying that.
Because
what you've said, and what Jonas is saying is that, you know, if you like, the seeds, the very beginnings of consciousness start with life.
Yes.
We've been there.
Yes.
We've all been there. We've all been a single cell. We've experienced that.
Yeah.
And it is just about possible. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that I remember being in the womb much later on. When I was a formed fetus. But some people do say they remember being an embryo, or they have a sense of being an embryo, what that was like.
Yes. But I guess the thing is that that experience, whatever it was, is then reflected in your brain now.
Yeah.
So you can't really know what it was then. But the fact it's left a trace is quite possible, but it's not any kind of proof in a way,
no.
You know. But if we lived in a different culture that had a different ontology, that accepted a different notion of what being is, because just from what I just said, do you see that our notion of being is the being of atoms and molecules quite deeply. We don't recognise the being of processes and... Yes? But even though when it's explained, you see that, yeah, quite obviously, you feel like you're made of this matter, right? And that your hand is the same hand as it was last year. But it's just the form that's changed. It's all the material in your hand has disappeared, but there's a certain underlying form that is just being reproduced, and you might say, oh well, you know, but maybe my being is the being of the matter at any moment, but in fact the only thing that defines your identity through your life is the enduring form of this body, and the thing that is kind of philosophically enlightening, I think, to look at that is that your form is immaterial. It's not material. And you know how shocking, how materialistic we are, and yet we've got our very being is, without being a Descartian and thinking there's some other substance there, our being is a kind of a pattern traced out by the movement of matter. I mean, later on, Jonas is going to say, a bit like a wave in the ocean. You know, that's the analogy. The wave is carried on the matter of the ocean, and yet it's quite distinct, the pattern of the wave. But of course, as far as we know, the wave doesn't have an experience of being a wave, whereas we do. We have an experience of being this form. We have the proof. It's very rare that you get any proof.
The wave is not the water.
Yes.
We think that the wave is the water.
Yeah.
No, it's the effect of the wave.
Yes.
The water is just an effect. The visual kind of data that we see that the sea.
Yes. The wave is a form.
Yes, yeah.
It's
a force.
It's, yeah, but it's the wave is just a form that the material is and it looks and it's it, to us it looks like that it's moving, but it's really the water's just going up and down. It's so it's uh, it's we're like that. The thing about materialistic science is, and I'm giving you next week's reading in one here, the thing about materialistic science is it would say, well, the reality of the atoms and molecules, that your form doesn't really show up. In, you remember Eagleman was saying about real true reality, about the electromagnetic radiation being the real true reality and the photons and everything, that's what physics says, what physics discovered, that's the real true reality. The thing that he discovers in the next essay is that, well, if that's the real true reality, then you and I just don't show up. We're a bit like the wave, a kind of an illusion. It's our being, because if you look at that, all of the material coming in and out of us all the time, being transformed, broken down, thrown out, waste products, air going in, all the rest of it, we're just a continual process. If materialism's true, then what's real is all the matter. That's what has the permanent reality, and we're just a kind of a ephemeral shape, being, you know, swirling around in this matter, and we live a kind of an illusion because our brains are continuously seeking out the forms of things. We don't see the matter, which is, for a science, the reality. We don't see the reality of the matter. We just see the forms, because we've got brains that extract forms. Illusory waves upon the ocean of matter. And that's really how science understands our experience. We're having a dream. That's why, you remember,
if something's an illusion, doesn't mean that it's not real.
Well, ontologically, it's got a secondary status.
I mean, it's like saying a dream's an illusion, isn't it? When we have a dream, that's an illusion. It's not actually going
no,
on.
No, you've got to think at a deeper level. That you're thinking at a human level.
Sorry.
No, I understand. your whole criteria of what an illusion is according to your human level understanding that is already understanding everything in terms of these forms. And what I'm saying is, as far as science is concerned, those aren't real. They don't exist. They don't have being.
And yet it's what they use to examine.
Yes, of course. But the real true being, you know, and you heard Dean was saying, the really true being is the being of the matter. The physical particles, the photons, the energy fields. That I'm just converting for you that this is how science sees what is real. Yes? And everything else, of course, we say we understand the world in terms of these forms, but the forms aren't real in the way that the matter is. The matter is the real stuff that carries the forms.
Right.
Yes? And the forms just don't show up for physics.
Right.
Yes?
Okay.
And Jonas's refutation of that, that in some sense these divisions into forms are entirely the work of our brains. Do you see that? If there were no brains, then all the forms would psh, and all that would be left would be the enduring matter. Do you see? You need a brain to interpret that there are forms here. That's why I'm saying it's an illusion. Take the brains away, you've just got the really, truly real, the matter that physics studies. Jonas's refutation of that is, well, that would be all very well, except that one particular form here, that in your experience, actually has an experience of being the form. Yes? So it isn't all matter, do you see? But in my saying that, I'm just repeating what I said at the very beginning, that material science carved things in half, ignored the subjective, and then ends up concluding everything's just matter. That's what's really real. Right? But all you need to do is just step out of that, back into your own experience, and you can say, well, no, this form is real, because this form's having an actual experience that distinguishes it from everything else. And not only that, it's having an experience of the forms of other forms that are also having experiences. So there's something wrong with this scientific view. Not that it's false, but that it's missing out what is staring you in the face. Does that? I feel like I'm having to tell Maria this more than everyone else. I don't know why. But are you getting what the critique of science is saying? It's incomplete. Not that we should reject it and throw it out and sack all the scientists, although maybe there are too many of them. Oh, said that our wife. That's another thing you wouldn't say if you were employed at a university. there are too many academics. Well, I think there might be. So, I mean, I've leapt over right till 2 o'clock and in a way summarised the next reading as well, because I felt like we needed to get to the heart of what Jonas is saying. Just let me spin through these slides and check there isn't anything. Oh, yes, if you did read this, so I'm just looking at the slide on organism and environment, if anyone's listening to the recording. He's out of date about the environment now. One of the big things that modern biology has realised is that it's not the environment that shapes the evolution, but evolution shapes the environment. It's feedback in both directions. Because think of it, the entire Earth is absolutely covered with vegetation. The life has created the atmosphere. Yes, the oceans are only what they are because of all the life that's lived in it. So there isn't really a clear. It used to be thought, oh yeah, it's the environment that shaped the species, but the species alter the environment that alters the species that alters the environment. There's a circular, what's called circular causation, which is really feedback going on there, to the extent that it's now becoming almost acceptable to think of the Earth as an organism, which is the Gaia hypothesis.
There is also this the right brain and left brain, they kind of shoot out this, they work separately, but they influence each other.
Well, that's another question. And have you read McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary? That's the book to read about the left brain and the right brain. And I feel like...
The Master?
The Master and His Emissary. The Master is the right brain, and the left brain is his emissary. But the emissary in the myth has taken charge of affairs. So it's a compelling story. Yes, existentialism. Gosh, I feel like just saying one little thing about this deep effect of evolution and this reversal on the self-understanding of humanity. Oh, I meant to give you a big speech on this. You see that there's a crucial. This is, and we'll wrap up with this, I think, because I want to get rid of this lecture and this distinction between nominalism and realism. And you'd think that your materialist would be the realist, but that ain't the case. So, before the theory of evolution, this idea of there being substantial forms was the idea that behind, say, the crow, you know, when we look at all the crows, we form an idea of there being crow. Yes? There was the idea that, yes, there actually is, behind all the crows, there really is an essential idea of crow. You know, when you generalize from lots and lots of examples, what you come to is an idea of Cronus. And realism says, yes, ideas like that are real. And this is true of all concepts, right? We form concepts of chairs, and we get an idea, yeah, there's such a thing as a chair. Another word for it is essentialism. There's the essence of chair, there's the essence of crow, there's the essence of being human. Now, Darwinism destroys that. It says, no, there's no essence of crow, there's no essence of being human. You're just a little way place on this process of evolution, and there's nothing essential about you. There's no idea of humanness there that was pre-existent that you conform to. That's all gone. What we have is nominalism, and what nominalism says is when we form concepts, and this is to do with language and everything that we think, all that in fact we're doing is we're recognising that a whole bunch of things have got something in common. And we could, the fact they've got something in common, we give a name to. Hence nominalism. So we say chair, because there's a whole bunch of objects here that we sit on. There's no essential idea chair. It's just a name we give, because if we didn't have such a name, we wouldn't be able to think of all the chairs at once. And similarly, human being. There's not that there's some essence of human being that determines what we are, like the rational animal, or being made in the image of God, that there was some pre-existing, you know, creator really who thought of what a human being is, and we're all kind of models of this prototypical idea. Darwinism says there are no prototypical ideas, nothing like that. It's not nominalism is the way it works here. All the concepts we use are just kind of abbreviations. So we don't have to run through all the individuals that we mean, we just use abbreviations. And those abbreviations enable us to think more efficiently. It's just another little trick of evolution, that language enables us to express what the brain was doing anyway, because the animals generalise. The animals recognise tiger. It doesn't have to say, I saw that. I saw Harry the tiger yesterday, and he's very dangerous, I'll run away from Harry. But now I've seen Eric the tiger, but he's different, so I won't run away from him. Now, obviously, the animals do it too. They generalise from experience, but there's no essential idea behind anything, including, I mean, ideas of right and wrong. They're just names we give to certain kinds of behaviours. I'm giving you a very accelerated picture here. So this means there's no authority, there's no pre-existing authority that has developed any kind of scheme about how we should live here. We're utterly on our own. And we have to invent our own meaning in the knowledge that there is no meaning. This is the existential position. There's no essential being. There's no essential. There's no, I'm going to be a good person. You can invent an idea of goodness, and you can try and live by it. And you might find that if you invent an idea of goodness and you try and live by it, that you'll enjoy your life more than if you live in another way. But there's nothing behind it to give it any justification. It's entirely up to you. And you are utterly free. This is, I'm sure, have you all done your existentialism to some extent or other?
It's the whole culture is existentialist.
All I want to say is that there's a deep connection between that and Darwinism. There was no existentialism before Darwin. Darwin destroyed the idea of what we call the immutable species. Once the immutable species went, the idea that there's some essential idea behind our being here and behind our being human, suddenly the abyss opens. And for Descartes, It's an abyss of freedom and nausea. Yes?
It's Sartre.
Yeah.
Sartre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said Descartes, but I meant Sartre.
Descartes's a long way
back. Yeah. I was just testing you there to check you're awake at the end.
Yeah.
And of course, nihilism follows from that. Because the next thing is that reason falls. Right? Reason is just a correct way of thinking that corresponds with the way the world works. So if you think according to reason, then your thinking corresponds to some of the ways that the world functions. Yes, two things can't be true at once. That's the way things function in the world. So when you think reasonably, you're more effective. But you can't use reason to justify anything. It's just a means to functioning. You'll be more effective in that, and how you act in the world if you use reason, because reason conforms to the way the world works. But you can't, on that basis, reason about why you should do something. There isn't. I mean, you can be, except utilitarian wise. You can reason that I'll get more money if I do this. But reason can't give you any ultimate grounds, philosophically or moralistically. It's got nothing to say. What you choose to believe philosophically or moralistically, you can reason about it, but reason isn't ever going to bring you to the correct premises. There are no correct premises. If you accept materialism down to its last dregs, the premises that you end up with, the ultimate ones you end up with, are entirely determined by the environment and your heredity. I'm hoping, Maria, where you're starting to feel the bleakness of this a little bit more.
I've felt the bleakness of it.
Yes.
I've worked through it,
yeah.
And I've realised it's not bleak at all.
It's not bleak at all.
No, it's a form of freedom.
That's it. It's the form of freedom. The question I want to give you to work with is that this existentialism and this nihilism that is emerged out of scientific materialism, how does it look when we then bear in mind our earlier demonstration that scientific materialism is incomplete and only gives you at best half the picture? Why would you base your entire understanding of our being here on Earth on a worldview that is obviously partial?
Well, who says that you don't? I don't think existentialists look at consciousness and human emotion and this kind of thing. I mean, even God. I mean, if you take somebody like what's the Nordic philosopher's, Kierkegaard. I mean, Kierkegaard was an existentialist, and he believed in God.
Well, he was retrospectively labelled as an existentialist.
Mm. Nietzsche's retrospective.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
I don't think. I mean, for me, a lot of existentialist ideas are not necessarily to do with having, you know, just purely.
But the point, I guess the thing I'm just laying on the table is this idea of having an absolute freedom is based on something that has arisen out of scientific materialism, and maybe it's not true.
Well, no, obviously you can't.
And if maybe it's not true, then. I wouldn't base my life on something that's so that's based on something that is obviously incomplete. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
And it was almost as if the existentialism got a certain authority from this from the way that our culture, and you see that, and a deep support, because this kind of freedom, we do have that kind of thing. A materialistic view does give us a kind of a utter freedom from any kind of constraint of whatsoever, of meaning or of morality.
Yeah, we still have to live with each other, don't we?
Yes, but then that just becomes a matter of, I mean, this is why I would like to say, a matter of calculation.
Well, it's also, I mean, you can also, you know, I think if you're going to, obviously you have to build up a morality for yourself from scratch, which is what I did, because you take away religion, out it comes, you're left with nothing. And I went through that whole thing about nothing means anything, what's the point, everything's a big joke, everything's bleak, everything's horrible. And then I realised I couldn't live like that, because it was driving me nuts. So then you have to start casting around for ideas that you can latch onto, and whether or not those ideas are illusory or whatever, it in a way, it doesn't matter. It's whether it makes sense to you. So I realised that I wanted to live my life in a way that was positive for myself and other people. That was a premise. The fact that may or may not have any cosmic significance whatsoever, I had to put that to one side. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It mattered to me. So there's a starting point.
Yes, but the fact that it mattered to you, I mean, this is the nice thing about existentialism can't really it can't get to the unconscious, if I'm speaking in a Jungian way. Our psyches are absolutely stuffed with I guess the simple word is with pre-existing meaning. So we're attracted, well, many of us are, towards other people. We have impulses of caring and of love and of self-sacrifice that aren't a matter of having read existentialist books, right? There are pre-existing tendencies in us that when we say there is no essentially human idea philosophically, if you actually look into your own inner world, there's loads of pre-existing tendencies in there, and some of them not so good as well.
And some of them completely different to other people,
yes,
as well.
But it's not as if you look in there and find that there is absolute freedom. You actually find that the dimension of freedom that you have is largely determined by the what's going on in your psyche, over which you don't really have any choice.
No, but you can become aware of it.
You can become aware of it, yes.
I'm
just going to close the recording down now. We'll call this chatting after the class.